7-year-old lad was entering the church, and he saw a list of names on a very formal-looking board. And the minister walked in and said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "Please, sir, what are all these names?" And the minister said, "Well, they are," in a very solemn voice, he said, "Well, they are the names of all the men and women who have died in the services." And the little boy thought for a moment. He said, "Is that the 10:30 or the 6:30 service?" Well, I'm glad to say at the present moment you're all alive and well, and maybe another matter in another 20 minutes, but I hope that... And I hope that you would think that our services have been a place of life, a place of hope, a place of rejoicing, a place of new newness, a new chapter, new goodness. What I thought we'd look at today is this story of the Good Samaritan. It's a long-standing story, a very well-known gospel parable, one of those stories that we know so well, or do we? One of those stories that we maybe don't listen to because we think we know it so well. It has a great deal to say to us in our generation about the role of church. One of the things that we've been focusing on as a leadership team in the last year, and more than that, is the strap line of train, equip, and release, which is something we've kind of worked internally within our own sort of working pattern. The idea that we give away what we have and what we can do, and we equip others to do it, and then we release them to do it, so that we either don't have to do it or we can get on and do something else. And in a sense, this is what Jesus is doing right through the Gospels. He's training up his people, he's equipping his people, and most importantly, he's releasing his people. And if ever there was a time when a church needed to be released, it's in our generation. The church needs to be released into a new chapter of hope and life. Very often in our own conversation as a circuit, Margaret, you know all about this, you were circuit steward, senior circuit steward, blessed be your name. There's been a conversation for a long, long time about decline. It's so depressing, isn't it? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Actually, the church isn't declining at all. The Methodist church is struggling, but the church in Britain is growing rapidly. The church in Britain is growing faster than it has done for a couple of generations. It's just growing in a different shape, in a different way, as people are being trained up, they're being equipped, and they're being released to take the gospel, the love of Jesus, to the world. This parable that Jesus, that we hear about from Luke, is about Jesus training and equipping and releasing. Because Jesus knew that he was up against attitude problems. He was up against attitude problems. He was up against a mindset that would not enable the equipping and the releasing of people. He was up against the religious authorities for a start. You've heard me say this more than once, so it's getting boring now. But when people ask me, am I religious, I always say no. I'm not religious, I'm a Christian. Because religion is one of the biggest shackles to the growth of the church. Religion is a man-made attempt to do and be the right thing in order to get closer to God. And the ceremonies and the traditions of the religious leaders in Jesus' day were stifling the work that he wanted them to do. One of the reasons why the priest and the Levite wouldn't touch the guy who was on the road on the floor was because he might have been dead. And for the priest, who was way, way up there in society, and the Levite, who wasn't far behind, for them to touch a dead body would make them ceremoniously unclean. So they couldn't possibly do that. Religion was getting in the way. Actually, the guy needed some help. But this religious mindset was in the way. We in our generation and in our lives today, we too, in our church life, whether we be Methodists or whether you're visiting from another church, another denomination, it doesn't really matter. We too have issues with attitude. When we see people in need, when we see the man who has been robbed lying on the floor, whether we be priest or Levite or Samaritan, we are faced in our generation with our own attitude difficulties. I want to show you a little video clip. It goes for a few minutes. It's quite interesting. And this video clip, I'll give you the background to it. It's a social experiment. The guy who lies on the ground and collapses is an actor. Well, there's two of them. The first one is a homeless man. Later on in the video clip, there is a well-dressed businessman who falls to the ground. And what is very interesting is the different attitude of the people who are walking by. So this is a social experiment. The people walking by are genuine. They are just absolutely real. It's just the guy on the floor is the actor. Let's take a look at this. Quite a powerful image, isn't it? How do you feel when you see someone in need? What's the feeling that you get? It's a truism, isn't it? How often do we walk through London and see people in need? How often do we see people at Woking Station or wherever? But as soon as somebody respectable is in need, we're straight there because they are worthy. Because actually they are proper people. They're ordinary people. They're people who actually deserve some attention. So the guy had a suit and a tie and money in his wallet. Therefore, he's worthy to be helped. But the guy who's homeless and dirty and smelly is not worthy to be helped because it's just the way he is. Now, that's not me preaching to you. Because I have walked by such people countless times, and I still do. Not always, but I still do. And I think that I would probably, if I was part of that video and been caught on that video, I would have been one of those who had walked past. And I would have probably gone to the side of the other guy. Isn't it odd? Now, what's going on here? What is actually happening? Because this is challenging the very call of the church in more ways than just feeding the hungry and helping the poor. This is challenging the attitude of the church in context of our relationship with the society in which we live. Because historically, church... Could somebody get me a glass of water, please? Thank you, Jean. Oh, it's all right. There's one here. You haven't drunk anything out of that, have you? Is it all right? I want to be well in retirement. I'll keep it now. Thank you. Where was I? Historically, we as a church have appealed to a certain brand of society. It was the same in my childhood when the Methodist Church was thriving big time. My father was a minister. Our church had, I think it was the third or fourth biggest church in the land. I think we had 800 members when I was a teenager. There were 400 in the Sunday school. There were 70 teenagers. It was a big, thriving, traditional Methodist church. But I don't remember there being anybody who was any different to anybody else. It appealed to a certain genre of society. Here at Trinity, we would say very openly to anybody that all are welcome. And I don't think there's anybody in this church membership who would not welcome anyone who might come into the church, because you're all very pastorally hearted. But of course, the reality is that they're not going to do that because we're different to them. So it's like an opposing magnet. Why would anybody off the street come into a respectable, well-dressed, wealthy church? What Jesus seems to be breaking in this parable is a mindset. He's actually breaking barriers. And what we have in our generation in the life of the church is a massive barrier between us and them. There's us who do what we do here. We all know how it works. We've been doing it for years. It's all perfectly normal to us. To a lot of people out there, it's just alien. It's just doesn't mean anything. And Jesus is recognizing this as he tells this parable. Because he knows that the fulfillment of his gospel must break down religious barriers and social barriers and barriers of class and wealth or poverty or whatever. And the message has to be got across that all are equal. That there is no such thing as wealth or poverty in the kingdom. A person is a person. And you'll know from the gospel stories that Jesus never treats anybody any different to anybody else. Whether it's a poor, blind, lame man or a child or a woman caught in adultery or a tax collector. Nothing wrong with tax collectors, HMRC, I'm sorry. A crooked tax collector or the rich young man who goes away sad because he couldn't follow Jesus. Jesus treats them all exactly the same. And he's doing the same with this principle here. And what is just really, really interesting is that for our culture, we don't quite recognize the significance of a Jew meeting of a Samaritan meeting somebody who was probably a Jew who has been robbed. The road from Jericho to Jerusalem is about 18 miles. I've been on that road in a vehicle. It's a modern highway. It still goes through mountains and hills, In Jesus' day, it was probably just a track or a path, enough for a mule, maybe a cart. But it was definitely a route which took it through territory which was prone to robbery and people being what we would call mugged. It was a very common occurrence for that to happen and for people to have their things stolen. So on this road we have a priest and a Levite who we know about, people soaked in religion and knowledge and wealth, and they are apparently people of integrity and social standing, probably well-dressed, couldn't possibly lower themselves to this level. And then the Samaritan comes along. Now, the history of the feud, this is not just a minority group who are a little bit disliked, like two groups of people in a modern city who come from opposite side of the tracks. This is a massive, massive void, not a void, wrong word, a massive chasm between Jew and Samaritan. The history of the feud between the Jews and the Samaritans goes back to around the 700s BC, when the Assyrians conquered Israel and took most of its people into captivity. And shortly after that, the Assyrians brought Gentile colonists to resettle the land. And those foreigners brought with them their pagan idols, which the remaining Jews began to worship alongside the God of Israel. Intermarriage took place, culture got all interwound, and the Samaritans became the descendants of those Jews who mingled with the Gentiles. The Jews despised the Samaritans, utterly despised them. They were utterly hated because they were not pure. They were not Jew. They had intermarried, interbred, if I can use that phrase, with the Gentile world. And here we have the underdog, if you like, in the story, helping the Jew on the ground. So in our video, we see the underdog is on the ground and all the capable people are walking past. In this story, we have the underdog walking past and the Jew on the ground. Jesus showing that actually we're all the same. There's no such thing as an underdog in society. There is no such thing in the kingdom as one who is less worthy or less precious or less valuable or less able or has less potential than anybody else on the face of this planet. Yes, their lives may be racked by pain of relational breakdown, their racked by drug abuse or alcohol abuse or just general lack of ability to look after themselves. But everyone is equal. Everybody. Everyone is equal. I would love to stand here with a string of stories of the things that I have done to help lots of people. And it's a very, very short list. And I feel greatly challenged by that. On the odd occasions when I have, or Liz and I have come across somebody and helped them, it's been incredibly rewarding. And when those things happen, you realize that the person that you're dealing with is actually just a normal person for whom life has gone pear-shaped. And there was a guy huddled in a sleeping bag a couple of weeks ago outside Asda, what do you call it? Lion. I keep getting blanks. Lion Retail. And he had his dog with him, like they often do. He's filthy dirty. It wasn't a couple of weeks ago because it was before the warm weather. And I could feel myself taking a wide berth because you don't know what to do, do you? And I just felt God say, "What are you doing? It's not difficult to buy him a sandwich." That was all it was. It's just not difficult. And I went to him. He was huddled up and he looked a bit startled. And I said, "Are you hungry?" And he said, "Oh, I'm hungry." And I said, is the dog hungry? He said, the dog's hungry. I said, what do you like? Oh, mate, he said, oh, I'd love a sandwich and a drink. How hard is that? How hard is it? I don't have to, you don't need training for it. I said, what sort of sandwich would you like? Oh, ham and cheese. I'll see what I got. What does the dog like? He said, pork pies. Whether the dog ever got the pork pies, I'm not sure. I went in, I bought a really big packet of mini pork pies. They didn't have ham and cheese sandwiches, but they had ham sandwiches. I bought him two packets, and I bought him a great big block of cheese. I bought him water. I mean, come on. A few quid out of my back pocket. It's nothing. And I took it to him, and you would have thought it was Christmas Day, because nobody would help him. What is it that we have to do just to make a difference? Now, if I was really good, I'd have put him in my car and taken him home. And some of you would do that, and I know some of you do that. I have yet to achieve that level of service. Jesus is saying, look, my kingdom is for everybody. It's for all people in all times and in all places. And if we can learn to help others, how amazing it would be, as in terms of witness and in terms of the power of the gospel. In terms of Trinity, I think there are a number of you here, and I know a number of you are heavily involved with social work, and I know one or two of you work regularly with folks who are less fortunate. So I know those of you who do that, and I bow to you. But in terms of our culture as a church, I really do think, much as we love our respectability and our facade that we have on a Sunday, I really believe we would be more effective if we could just be more ordinary. I've tried to dress it all down a bit. I started off with a dog collar 2 years ago, and I've gradually gone down. If I stayed another year, I'd be in a shorts and a t-shirt, stood here. Gradually dismantle the whole thing. We have to be approachable. We have to be ordinary. We have to be. In our ordinary lives out there, God is so good. I just want to read to you a little story, which is, I just think it's just a nice story. I'll finish with this. I found this. This is a guy called Thomas Long, who remembers asking his grandmother about a very early photograph, yellowed and faded, on his grandmother's wall, of a young man in America in a union officer's uniform. And his grandmother is from South Carolina, which would have been Confederate during the Civil War of the 1860s. And the little boy was always intrigued by, why is there a Union soldier? A little bit like one of us having a picture of a Nazi officer on our lounge wall. And the grandmother said to her grandson, who was young at the time, she said he was a good man. She said he was a chaplain in the Union Army. In May of 1862, after the smoke had cleared from the field of battle at Williamsburg, Virginia, this Union chaplain, in his dark blue uniform, rode out onto the field on his horse to see if there were any wounded troops who had been left behind. And he came across a 19-year-old enemy Confederate soldier. Those are the guys with the pale gray uniforms. He was lying wounded, and he was terrified in a ditch. The boy had taken a bullet that had practically severed his leg at the knee, and he was slowly bleeding to death He was just 19 years old. And this is what Long says, now obviously an elderly man. He says, feeling compassion even for the enemy, the chaplain lifted the boy out of the ditch and put him on his horse and took him to the Union medical tent, where a surgeon amputated his leg at the knee, bandaged him up, and stopped the bleeding, saving his life. When the boy was strong enough to travel, this chaplain got together enough money to see that he was sent home to his grateful and relieved parents in South Carolina. This 19-year-old Confederate soldier grew up to be a minister himself, a teacher, and eventually a college president. And what is most significant to me, my great-grandfather. The chaplain who rescued my great-grandfather and saved his life was the Reverend Joseph Twitchell, a ministerial graduate of Yale College. And after the war, by the way, he was a good friend of Mark Twain. My great-grandfather and his enemy Unionist savior were bound together by this humane moment amid the ravages of war, and they remained correspondents and very close friends throughout the rest of their lives. Nobody had to preach the parable of the Good Samaritan to my family. We had lived it. Isn't that a lovely story? That's one enemy meeting another enemy. A little bit like the Samaritan meeting the man who had been robbed. For you and me, most of the folks around us in need are not enemies. Are they? Not really. They're just folks for whom life has dealt some raw cards, some raw deals, some bad cards. I preach this sermon to myself. We shall see if it does any good. Amen. Let's sing together. Lord of all hearts.